Call this meeting to order now. I know there are some more people coming in, but depending on the amount of input that we get from the audience and from the teleconference people, we have a follow-up meeting this afternoon, and we don't want to run into their time. So we will try and start now. I presume that everybody who would like to have oral input has signed up in the back of the room so that we have your names. We have with us today Representative Joe Sitton from Fairbanks, Representative Pete Cott, and Representative Gary Davis from Soldotna. And this does constitute a quorum, so we will be moving along. It is not my intention to move this out of committee today, and I'll give you a brief explanation of what that is all about. It has been a rather trying interim, as I understand, from the main testimony that you'll hear today, Mr. Ken Boyd of the Department of Natural Resources, who has, as my aide says, may not be the father of this document, but at least he's the midwife. And so we will hear from Ken, who will lead us through the bill. We have a tenuous at combination from all of industry, and it was my intent, some of you may recall from last session, that I didn't want to move the exploration licensing bill out of the Oil and Gas Committee because there wasn't unanimity among the potential participants. And because of that, it was my feeling that it would be better to get what we now seem to have and move something that would be acceptable, hopefully usable, by all the members of the industry, and that seemed to be the case, as some of you may be aware of the train wreck that happened in the Senate. And I don't mean it in disrespect to the other body, but it just seemed that there are enough rocks thrown at the hand that feeds the state as it is, that we don't need to have squabbles among the people themselves. I am probably preaching to the choir, but I would like it on record that there has been, over the last several years, a loss of nearly three-fourths of the oil companies who otherwise might be operating in Alaska that do operate successfully, large companies in many cases, who operate successfully in the lower 48. Certainly among those who used to operate here in Alaska, Chevron, Conoco, Mobil had several wells drilled on the North Slope, Shell, Texaco. These are major, major companies who have decided that, as we heard this morning in the Alliance, that some of the pancakes in other parts of the world taste better than the unrest, the political climate right here in the state of Alaska. To me, that sends a terrible, terrible message. We are one of the United States. We are not contiguous, certainly, but this should be the place that most major oil companies are looking for oil, especially in a world that is potentially at unrest. There seems to be war somewhere all over the globe, and to force major players outside this state because of more stable political climate, to me, is unacceptable. We certainly have an existing five-year leasing program that most of all of the people that I see in the audience are familiar with. This is a competitive leasing schedule that goes through a series of hoops before a particular area can be put up for competitive bidding. And this is time-consuming. It ends up quite often with a checkerboard-type lease arrangement, which then, because of standbacks and perhaps some unleased acreage in the near vicinity, creates a cloak and dagger type of arrangement. Partnerships sometimes are forced, and when the information is received, if there is unleased acreage nearby, it can be kept sealed for quite some time. That may be beneficial for the players in the industry, and I'm referring to players not in the sense of anything but the highest respect, but it is somewhat of a game, and it's not in the best interest of the state to keep such information secret. the major benefit I see of allowing certain areas to be explored without this concern that there is someone next door to you or someone looking over your shoulder has been successfully used in many parts of the world, and certainly in some of our basins and depicted on the map on the wall with the pipeline and with the red dots indicating ports, so that in some cases there are basins adjacent to ports that would not necessarily need to come to the TAPS line. But I put that on there to show that there is in fact a lot of wilderness, certainly unexplored areas, not dissimilar to other parts of the world, and that such a vehicle as exploration licensing, large block leasing, whatever the term you put on it, I think is something that certainly is due. And I want to compliment Mr. Boyd and the industry itself for really, really working diligently over the interim to put together something that they can all agree to. We have the results of that. Unfortunately, as is often the case, the wording that's agreed to is not necessarily in the format that is required for legislative action. And so I want to put the caveat that today we will be looking and we will be reviewing that agreement that the industry has looked at, that Mr. Boyd has worked so hard on, and knowing that that intent will be put into the documentese, or what legalese, whatever is the proper terminology, to end up with a bill that can be acted upon, hopefully quickly, but that it may not look the same. And I will make available the, assuming that we get through this and we've still got unanimity of desire, we will draft the bill in bill form, draft the words in bill form, and I will make those copies available to be sure in your own minds that what we're sending on is in fact what this very, very delicate agreement among the various operators has been. And further, for the record, and certainly not for the audience as I see them now, we are faced in this state with a fiscal dilemma. We have for years and years, at least since the pipeline started, depended quite largely on the income from the oil industry. That green line has represented, well, that plus the Cook Inlet, has represented varying from 94 to currently somewhere in the mid-80s percent of the state's income, far, far, far in excess of any state in the lower 48. The big oil-producing states in the past, Oklahoma and Texas, have never, ever required or depended so heavily upon the oil industry as does the state of Alaska. And yet we not only look to it for our support, but we sometimes are a little overbearing on it. But the fact remains that that great cornucopia on the North Slope is declining. And it's not only dropping in the number of barrels, and that even though we are fortunate, extremely fortunate, that fields have been brought on, those fields, with the perhaps the exception of the Kuparik, which is America's second largest field, those fields are at best in the 100,000 barrel a day category, and we can somewhat offset or decrease the rate at which Prudhoe Bay declines, but there's no way without bringing on three or four per year that we can offset and hold constant the production coming from the North Slope. That currently has been coupled by a significant downturn in the price of oil. So we're smitten by a double-edged sword, and it behooves us as quickly as we can to do something about that. Certainly the state is in the process of trying to come up with alternate forms of income. Certainly we have a lot of other things, fish and timber and tourism and those things, but to date those have not been a significant income when you consider percentage-wise of the income that is necessary to run the state. It still remains oil and will remain so, even at a diminishing rate well into the 21st century. So I think it's particularly timely that we now get into this large block leasing that may be an incentive to the current participants, the current operators in the state, albeit they have dropped in half, but we may even be able to attract outside companies to come back, and that's the fond hope. Knowing, as you look at that map, that even if they're successful, and this has been brought to our attention many times with the debates that have raged for years on Anwar, that even if there is a major discovery, it will be several years before that major discovery can ever be brought to market. So delay is critical. And so with that in mind, I would like to turn the meeting over to Ken Boyd with the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas, who is extremely familiar with this. Ken, if you would kind of go through the background, the nuances of the bill, and if we could hold questions from the panel until termination or the end of Ken's presentation. I'm sure you'll be available for any questions.
Absolutely.
And that would go also for the audience.
Would you sound off so we know that you can actually hear us?
We're hearing you here in Juneau just fine.
Thank you. Fairbanks? No, when you came down for that, Rich?
One was exploration licensing, so a concept that's used worldwide,
and another concept of extending our exploration incentive credits program, which is a separate bill that will be addressed another time. From there, we started to craft the bill. The bill, in fact, was introduced in the second session of the 17th session. It never really got much of a hearing, and there was a lot of talk about it and a lot of controversy. And between the session, between the 17th and the beginning of the 18th session, we crafted a new bill. The bill was introduced into your committee and to your counterpart committee on the Senate side by the governor. Your committee heard the bill, at least on several occasions that I'm aware of, testimony from different people talking about bonding and other issues that we'll get into in a minute. On the Senate side was, at least last session, where the fireworks were. I make no predictions for this session. It was heard in oil and gas, it was heard in finance, and there were a number of amendments, a number of committee substitutes made, and we'll get into some of those changes. In front of you, or you have a little cheat sheet that I've prepared. It's just a one-pager printed on two sides. I would ask that you read the bottom line of the second page first. It says disclaimer. This document is for discussion purposes only. It is not intended to be a comprehensive description of the provisions of the bill. This little sentence is sort of sets the tone for what's happened between sessions. When things happen that I characterize as a tug of war with six ropes. The bill was pulled in about six different directions, and when time ran out, the knot fell in a particular place and time, and I think nobody was particularly happy with where the knot fell. So between sessions, industry has worked with me, with themselves, to try to reach a consensus, which we have done. But Chairman Green characterized it as a tenuous alliance. I would characterize it somewhat differently. I think it's actually quite firm, but I've characterized it before, and I'll characterize it here as made out of glass. It's very, very strong, but you can't bend it, and if you try to, you'll break it. So I realize, and I know industry realizes, that there'll be changes made to the bill with time, but we're going to try to work very carefully to make sure that everybody is on board with these changes. So let me go back now and begin with what's happened with time. The as you'll see in the little sheet, there are two live versions of the bill. There is House Bill number 199, which exists in your committee. It's the governor's original bill. There is committee substitute for Senate Bill 150, which exists on the Senate side. And we have the October 25th draft, which of course is a draft document ready to be considered and today. The original bill, Let me move through the features. And again, these are the highlight features. We can get into any details. Geographical restrictions. In the original bill, the concept of exploration licensing was to apply to a lot of land in Alaska, virtually anything that had never been leased before. There's a lot of discussion about this, and as Chairman Green said, the one great reason for the exploration licensing bill is to give the company that wants to explore now that opportunity to explore. The current five-year leasing program works just fine in many areas. But in these remote basins, when you have a lot of, if you hold a conventional lease sale, you wind up with a lot of ownership of people who have different goals and different timelines for exploration and development. The exploration licensing program gives the company with the time and the money and the inclination get on with their business and get out and explore these very remote basins. So we believed that it was appropriate to limit the bill or the concept to the areas we felt it would work the best. We felt that the five-year program worked just fine in the areas of the North Slope, what I'll call the sweet spots of the North Slope and the sweet spots of the Cook Inlet. And through a series of meetings and hearings, and you should all have copies of these two maps. The first map of the North Slope shows the delineation or delimiter of what's off limits. And what's off limits to exploration licensing at this time is lands north of the Umiut baseline, which you'll see as a dashed line running across the center of the page. It's about 6930 north. Everything south of that line and outside the Cook Inlet box will be available for exploration licensing. And we feel that it still opens up the areas in the foothills two exploration licensing, we believe they're most applicable. On the Cook Inlet, you'll notice there's a box drawn on the Cook Inlet, which again separates out what you would consider the traditional Cook Inlet type plays, but leaves the areas outside the Cook Inlet available for exploration licensing. The next couple of items in the bill are all linked, and it's important to remember that the linkage. There's not a way to discuss some of these things without sort of moving back and forth, and I'll try to do it in as least confusing way as possible. One of the things, go back up, the way the bill works is that, in general, is that instead of having a bonus bid, there'll be a work commitment. A company will come in and have a work commitment that they have to subscribe to for a period of time. With this work commitment goes certain conditions. One of the conditions is a bond. The bond is the state's assurance that the work commitment will be fulfilled. In the original bill, in the original House Bill 199 introduced by the governor, bonding was on a dollar-for-dollar basis. In other words, if a company came in and wanted to do $50 million worth of work, the bond was $50 million. Any amount of work that they didn't do would be forfeited to the state. This was thought to be too harsh a standard, and there was a lot of discussion about this. In the committee substitute, there was a scheme whereby the companies would come in and bid a work commitment, and they'd have to bond, and they'd have to describe the work commitment. In other words, we do so much seismic and so much aeromagnetic, so much gravity, whatever. And you'd bond 10% of that each year. The problem with this is that it requires the commissioner then to weigh what something is worth over time and what something is worth on a relative basis. In other words, is 100 miles of seismic in year two worth more than a well in year four? And if so, how much more? So it was very difficult, and he had a lot of discretion, a lot of difficulty to decide how would you actually decide who won. So we worked through this. And I should say also that there were other entities that believed there should be no bonding, that bonding there shouldn't be any bonding at all. That the state's idea was to get money into the ground. Why should there be any bonding? In fact, if there's no bonding, it's very difficult to determine who wins the work commitment because there's no standard. If your feet aren't held to the fire, if you have no obligation to pay if you don't perform, then you can bid anything you want. The bid could be any number if you never had any penalty to pay. So we felt there was some middle ground. And I believe we've reached middle ground now in this October 25th draft. It goes something like this. It's been called in the past the dreaded bonding formula. It's really not very hard. You take your work commitment and you subtract off the amount of work you've done up to the point in time that you're at, and you divide it by the number of years left.
Okay.
Starting out, let's say you've got a $50 million work commitment and you're going into your first year of license. You're just starting. You haven't done any work. So it's $50 million minus zero divided by 10. We'll say it's a 10-year license. Your bond for the first year is $5 million, 50 minus 0 divided by 10. You do $5 million worth of work your first year. What's your bond for the second year? It's 50 minus 5 divided by 9. It's $5 million again, and so on. So the state is not protected, if you like, on a dollar-for-dollar basis, but certainly there's a fairly high standard. If you don't perform your work commitment, your bond is forfeited and you lose your license. Now, I want to hold that right there for a minute. Another feature that was not present in the House bill is relinquishment. Many of the contracts, concession style leasing overseas, have relinquishment clauses. Relinquishment simply means that at some point in time in your license period, you give back, you put back in the pot some of the land that you were originally given your license, presuming that you haven't nominated right to the edge of an oil and gas basin. In the original bill, there was no relinquishment provision at all. In the Senate, a relinquishment provision was placed in that at the end of the fourth year, you would relinquish 25% of your original license area. And then on each succeeding anniversary, you would relinquish 10% of the original acreage. Once again, the industry felt this was too harsh a standard. So through a long series of meetings, we came up with a compromise that appears in the October 25th draft. It has a couple of parts. I have to back up just one second. One of the other features of this, of the October 25th draft, is that you have to do 25% of the work in 4 years. That doesn't appear anywhere else. But again, these things are so tightly linked, it's difficult to speak about one without lopping into the other. So they have to do 25% of the work commitment in the first 4 years. But this was sort of a balance, because if they do 50% of the work in the first 4 years, there is no relinquishment. None. We felt this is a benefit to the state because it pushes the work into the beginning, the royalty owner's mantra of more sooner. If they don't do, they have to do 25%. If you don't do 25% in the first four field seasons, you lose your license. Bingo, you're gone. But if you do something in between, then they do forfeit, or you do relinquish 25% of your acreage, of the original acreage. And each succeeding year, you lose 10% of the remaining acreage, not the original acreage, the remaining acreage, up to a maximum of 50%. So I characterize this then as a balance, where we've given companies the opportunity to not relinquish if they work sooner. We've forced them, in a sense, to work sooner by requiring the 25% of the work to be done. If you think through the bond formula for a minute, it'll occur to you that you could really work very late in the period, and you can still be bonding, but you wouldn't have to do anything. This way, it pushes the work forward, but gives the industry an opportunity not to have to relinquish any land if they're able to do quite a bit of work up front. Those are really the key points. I mean, the bonding and the relinquishment, the ability to state has to have some satisfaction that they are protected, yet not such a great burden that companies are foreclosed from being able to work. The other aspects here, competitive bidding, in the bill on the House side, it was oral outcry. In other words, people would sit in front of the commissioner and bid up a work, assuming there was more than one licensee or potential licensee, in dollars. There was an objection to this, that it was difficult sometimes for some companies to be able to have that sort of authorization on a second's notice, whether to go a little higher. So in the Senate version and in this version, in the version in front of you, the October 25th draft, we have a competitive sealed bid. The bids will be sealed. And I should also say that we've defined what monies will be allowed or be counted toward the work commitment. You can imagine that sometimes a smaller company may have a real or perceived benefit over a larger company and be able to do a certain job cheaper. And again, this may or not be true, but it could be true. Lower overhead, certainly. So we've tried to keep out the overhead costs and put in the direct exploration expenditure. That's how it's defined. That's what they'll be able to count against their work commitment. Acreage chargeability. In the beginning, well, it doesn't have to go as well. The way the acreage chargeability will go is that the license area will not be charged against the 500,000 acre cap. As you know, in current statute, a company can have 500,000 upland acres and 500,000 offshore acres. The license area will not count toward that 500,000. But at the lease conversion, anything that's converted to lease will count. The application fee, there's an application fee in the original bill of $1 an acre. The fee now we've set at a lower number to be set by the commissioner of not more than $1 an acre. It's a very minimal amount of money. The minimum work commitments, and I've already talked about this, in the original bill, all you had to do was you had to fulfill your work commitment. If you didn't do it, you lost a lot of money because of the bond. And that was really it. And in the Senate bill, you had a yearly commitment, and you had to review it every year. And again, this is a lot of work of reviewing things, and how much did you get done? If you promised 1,000, you got 800 done, was that enough? But now, again, with the bonding formula, the way it works, the only standard is that you have to complete 25% of the work by the end of the fourth year. There's no necessity to look over anybody's shoulder. The only real thing you have to identify is whether the bond has, is make sure the bond is in place at the beginning of each year. All right, Title 46, Financial Responsibility. This was not addressed at all in the bill on House Bill 199, and in fact, it is not present in this October 25th draft. But in the Senate, a motion was made to lower, or amendment was made, to lower the financial responsibility for onshore exploration facilities from $5 million to $1 million. There was an awful lot of discussion about this. This does not fall under DNR responsibility, Title 38, which is where this bill appears. It's, in fact, a subset of Title 46, and it is part of a financial responsibility package that was passed several years ago in response to the Exxon Valdez accident. And it was, I believe, HB 567 that introduced a lot of new bonding requirements, or financial responsibility, not just bonding. But the long and short of it is that this amendment was made to drop the responsibility for onshore exploration facilities from $5 million to $1 million. And in my view, this is what finally defeated the bill. We've taken those provisions out, but have the full recognition that somebody at some point in time may put them back in. So we're just taking it out as a convenience. What we've put together is a package that is all exploration licensing and no anything else. And that goes to the next one as well, the so-called 90-day provision, which again was not addressed in the original bill. And we, the Division of Oil and Gas, introduced this. In the current five-year program, there's a provision that a lease sale has to be held within 90 days of the quarter which is scheduled. It was originally put there to solve what I call the evil commissioner problem. An evil commissioner could hold industry at bay by just saying, I'm not going to hold this lease sale. I'm going to just keep delaying it. Perhaps to receive something in return. I won't even speculate what that might be. But the 90-day provision says that now you have to hold within 90 days or fold up the schedule entirely and goes back to the whole process again. In fact, this provision is now being used against us by, I will have to characterize, extreme groups that want the lease sale program to fail. And what this provision says is we'd like to remove the 90-day provision, and it essentially goes back to the way it was. So the lease sale will be held. If it's on the schedule, the lease sale will be held, and it doesn't have this 90-day drop-dead date. We've removed that from this bill. It does not appear in the October 25th draft. It will appear in some other legislation that will be introduced in a way we're not quite clear with yet, but some Title 38 changes. We still have these in conceptual form. But in being able to take everything out of this bill that isn't exploration licensing, we felt it was right to remove that as well. So we've gone through the process. You've fulfilled your board commitment. At the end of that time, you can take as much of the acreage you want and go to lease. The only thing that really changes there is then the provision of Title 38 can kick in, and you'll work under Title 38 with anything, or if not, you don't have to take anything to lease if you don't want to. It just goes reverse back to the state. The only change here then is the rental kicks in. There has been no rental during the license period, but now your rental kicks in at $3 an acre. $3 an acre is the highest number we have right now. Our current program starts $1, and it goes up $0.50, up to $3. We're just going to kick it because of the time that the companies have had to work. We're going to start the rental at $3. And it does prevent probably taking a little of the extra moose pasture that you might not really want. I think I've covered most of it. There are some word changes and other things that, I mean, I could go through the bill page by page and show you changes that were made. I'm not sure that there's anything any particular necessity to do that. I think we've gone through the geographic exclusion, the direct exploration expenditure, the bonding, the relinquishment, conversion to lease. change, I'll call it, there's a force majeure provision that the commissioner can extend certain payments and things by acts of God, war riots or acts of God, to be extended after the license. And I think I'll join the chairman in congratulating industry on a really difficult period. They really worked very, very hard, and a lot of consternation. But and there was a lot of give and take. I think if people come to the table, I doubt that anybody will say, if I wrote the bill, if they wrote the bill, this is the bill I would write. And I think that's a sign this is a pretty good piece of work. And they're really to be commended for that kind of work, because it really truly is a give and take in here. And I think probably nobody got exactly what they wanted, but they've all said, I hope they will say to you, that this is a tool that they'll all be able to use, and we're just hopeful that we'll be able to get some exploration out in some of these interior basins, attract some new companies, make some new discoveries.
Thank you very much, Ken. I think now, are there any questions of any of the committee members before we take testimony from the members of the audience? Has Fairbanks joined us yet? Apparently not.
No, they haven't.
Okay. Representative Sanders?
Mr. Chairman, Chief Coyne, often we get a little bill like this and it results in volumes of regulations and rules. Can we feel confident that the rules and regulations that develop from this will support the original intent of this legislature and the industry if we were to pass this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sanders, yes, it would be my entire intent to write regulations. You know, a lot of regulations in the lease side are certainly already in place, but I think the kind of regulations that have to be written are things that deal with strictly mechanical things. I think most of the guts of how it works are in law. But, for instance, when do you hold, once a year we're to hold, have a period where we offer these licenses. We can't really have it every day of the year, because all of the Title 38, all of the best interest finding, all of the environmental work we have to do for a license, for a lease sale now, has to be done for a license area. There's all of that, all the best
interest
procedure. So a lot of that is already in Title 38. So it's going to be new procedures. You know, for instance, we hold the lease sales on a regular schedule, which is all covered in statutory regulation. Now here, we're going to hold it once a year. We may have to decide, well, when? And will it be a month or, you know, 3 weeks, or how long should we have that open? But I think there'll be nothing really substantive. There'll be some definitions that have to be done. There are some terms in here like geological and geophysical data. Those terms are currently defined in regulation, but they're very out of date, and they need just to be polished up a little bit. There's been so much new technology since those were written. There are new remote sensing techniques. Geochemistry is a more viable tool now. I think those things have to be included, but I believe that you can be confident that the guts, the true spirit, is in the law, and the regulations will be nothing but the augmentation and the simple implementation of what's in statute.
Thank you. I just wanted to mention that Kotzebue is now on the line. Jerry, go ahead.
One other thing, this has all been done with a lot of good intentions. A lot of people have done a lot of work on it. But my experience is nothing happens until somebody sells something. If we do this, do we have any real commitments that some of these companies in the industry are actually going to take advantage of it and go to work on it right away?
I don't have anything in writing, Representative Sanders, nor am I likely to get anything in writing, but I believe the companies would not have spent so much time on this and effort on this to make it right if they didn't have the intention of using it. It's too good an opportunity, and I hope there are people not in this room who will take advantage of it as well. And I certainly, I'm unable to speak for them, and maybe geophysical companies, maybe a lot of different people who may want to take advantage of some of these things. So I can't promise you. I especially can't promise you when I get the oil price report every day. I mean, it's not just the bill. It's a lot of other external factors. An oil company is always competing for exploration dollars, and there are fewer exploration dollars today than any time in recent history, probably. As Chairman Green mentioned, some of those dollars are going overseas. But I must say that I see things turning a little bit the other way. I see a real opportunity coming back to Alaska, because sometimes the grass is not always green on the other side. And some countries that have invited American oil companies to do business have learned that taxing is probably a pretty damn good idea. And so the new discoveries we've had, I mean, Kuplan was maybe a bit of a disappointment, but they're still drilling on Wild Weasel. BP is drilling at Yukon Gold. The work that's going to be done at Badami is being done at Badami. The Colville Delta is coming to life after all these years. Cook Inlet, everybody knows about Sunfish, and who knows what's next in the lower inlet. So I think the interest, the eyes are back, they're focused. Even people that are not here, I am certain, are pulling out their old seismic data and saying, where the hell did this Sunfish thing come from? What's going on at Yukon Gold and Badami? This is not the old place. We're not doing the same thing we did when we were here X number of years ago. I think as long as they may still be looking at that in terms of our conventional five-year program, but when they look, they'll see, well, here's something else we can do. We have this exploration license. We have this opportunity to work in these interior basins. So again, no promise, but I think there's a lot of opportunities.
Yes, Representative Cott.
Thank you. Can you perhaps identify, or at least suggest, what kind of administrative effect this bill will have on the Division of Oil and Gas? Are we going to add additional auditors or any personnel?
We have promised the commissioner that we will administer this program with no additional increase in staff as long as we don't have any decrease in staff. We will administer this program at status quo, but I've characterized it this way. I think of it as a startup business. The startup business generally starts small. And depending on the popularity of your product or service, your company will grow. And when you grow, you have new jobs. So I'm going to say that we'll administer this program in the beginning at status quo. But if this program grows and becomes extremely popular, which I think is something we all want, I would have to say that we'll be back before you, perhaps to ask for more people, perhaps for more money. But at the beginning, status quo.
Sounds like a nice problem to have.
Yes.
Any other questions from the committee?
I have one, if I might. We're talking about the fact that after short of 50% of the work commitment being done, but beyond 25%, so that the license area is at this time in the fourth year still intact, and then there begins some relinquishments.
Correct.
Who determines what area is relinquished?
There's a provision in the bill that the company will identify a compact and contiguous 25% of the acreage. If they don't do so, then the commissioner will identify the acreage to be deleted or relinquished.
That would apply also to subsequent 10%.
Exactly.
So this would, in effect, be administered very similar to the way you do unitization now?
Right.
Okay. And that might be where you start needing new people, huh?
Possibly. I hope people will do the 50% of the work. To report.
Oh, yes. There are no other questions. Are there any questions from any of our remote areas? I can understand Kotzebue just coming on may not have heard Mr. Boyd's input. He went through the highlights of the bill, the changes from the bills that were introduced in the middle of last session. If you have any questions about that, we might be able to take those at the end. But if there are any questions about Mr. Boyd's testimony, do you have anything now? If not, then we'll take testimony in the order that you signed in. And the first person we have to hear from is Bill O'Brien from Acreage. Bill, if you'll come.
Licensing proposed committee substitute for House Bill 199. And I want to thank this committee for requesting public comment. HB 199 is a bill that offers high potential for both Alaska and the oil and gas industry. It will attract investment to our state, target state land of interest to the industry, accelerate the pace of finding new oil and gas fields. All these factors are important because our existing fields are maturing. We know this is true because we've seen the decline of Prudhoe Bay oil field. Although other fields have come online recently, none compared to Prudhoe. Only a few short years ago, Trans-Alaska Pipeline was transporting 2.1 million barrels of oil a day. Today, total oil field production is averaging 1.6 million barrels daily. That loss is equivalent to losing about 5 Point McIntyre-sized oil fields. This continuing trend will have an adverse impact to both the oil industry and the state's economy. Alaska is a resource state, and our primary resources are oil and gas. These resources provide both public and private sector jobs, and we all know that 85% of state revenues are a result of oil production. These revenues have given us tremendous prosperity. If we are to sustain this prosperity, we must replace the declining production with new fields. Obviously, this requires exploration, and more importantly, it requires legislation that will make Alaska attractive to the industry. As you review this and other important oil and gas legislation this session, ask yourself a couple of questions. Of the companies that currently operate oil and gas fields today, how many are aggressively exploring within our state? And of the companies that have left in recent years, how many do you expect to return and explore? Not as many as should be, and not unless Alaska's business climate changes for the better. Alaska is virtually unexplored, yet U.S. oil companies are now investing more than half of their exploration and production capital overseas. I believe that exploration licensing can help bring these companies back to our state. This bill, if passed in the next session, will send a signal to the industry that we want to improve our business climate, that we want these companies working here in Alaska. And if we seriously want them to return, we must pass HB 199. Exploration and development requires time, a great deal of time, especially in Alaska. And quite frankly, we're running out of it. So I urge this committee to pass this bill in its present form early in the next session. We Alaskans must plan for the future, a future that includes aggressive exploration. We can't afford to do otherwise.
Thank you very much, Mr. O'Brien, and I would presume, and I'll make this, presumptions are always bad, but that your testimony as well as that of the others would be, as the potential committee substitute will be, the intent that was agreed to among the various operators and Mr. Boyle. Thank you.
Yeah, that's correct. I'd also like to comment to Representative Sanders' question earlier. And that is, I think we need to pass this legislation, drive it around the block, see how it does. If there isn't enough activity, I hope that we'll make improvements in the near future if we just don't get the level of activity of exploration that we need. But certainly, I endorse the current draft and hope that that'll move forward.
Are there any questions for Mr. O'Brien from the committee? How about from our satellites? Any questions of Mr. O'Brien? I hope they're there. Are you still there?
Cosby is on. I have no questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Juno? Juno, are you? Can you hear us? We're discussing the capital move, Juno. Can you hear? Thank you, Mr. Bill.
Thank you.
The next person we have, well, Ken has already talked. The next one is Judy Brady, representing AOGA. I would ask that people speak up just a little. They were having a bit of difficulty picking up the early part of Mr. O'Brien's testimony.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Judy Brady, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. The Alaska Oil and Gas Association, as you all know, is a trade association whose member companies account for the majority of oil and gas exploration, production, transportation, and marketing activities in Alaska. AOGA believes that large block licensing is an attractive addition to the state's leasing program to accelerate exploration potential development of Alaska's frontier areas. The association has established the following positions on large block exploration licensing legislation. AOGA supports a large block licensing program that does not apply to lands north of the Umiak baseline, lands south of the Umiak baseline that are within proposed competitive oil and gas lease sales 80, 87, and 88 prior to initial sale, and in the vicinity of Cook Inlet that are within the area bounded by the north boundary of Township 17 North, Seward Meridian, south boundary of Township 7 South, Seward Meridian, and the west boundary of Range 19 West, Seward Meridian. That's the same map that you looked at earlier. AOBA supports a program in which a license is conditioned upon the posting of an annual bond or other security in favor of the state, and in which the annual bond or other security is calculated as the entire work commitment expressed in dollars, less the cumulative expenditures as of the last day of the most recent project year, divided by the remaining years of the exploration license. And again, that's the same proposal as explained to you by Ken Boyd. AOBA supports a competitive program in which all licenses are awarded on the basis of written sealed bids for a total dollar work commitment. The commissioner should adopt regulations to evaluate competing proposals. AOBA supports a program in which conversion from license to lease is under existing state statutes, and in the testimony that I will give to you, you'll see the statutes, the numbers of the statutes. And upon conversion, such a lease is subject to acreage chargeability under existing statutes. AOBA supports a program in which any relinquishment of a license area does not occur before the fourth anniversary of the license, and each year thereafter is a percentage relinquishment of the remaining license area not to exceed 50% of the original license area. As an incentive for early evaluation of a license area, AOBA believes no relinquishment should be required if the licensee has expended 50% of the approved work commitments by the fourth anniversary of the license. The large block exploration license legislation proposed by the Department of Natural Resources on October 25, 1993 is consistent with the AOBA position on exploration license legislation. AOBA supports the proposed Department of Natural Resources draft. We have a copy attached to that. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Brady. Are there any questions of the panel? Any questions from our remote satellite of Ms. Brady? Testifier we have is Brad Penn of Marathon. Oh, I'm sorry, Pete Nelson of Texaco.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Pete Nelson, and I'm the land manager for Texaco's Alaskan region. I appreciate the opportunity to share Texaco's position on large block license. We strongly support DNR's draft bill dated October 25, 1993, which is before us today, and AOBA's position as presented here today. We believe it will encourage accelerated exploration and development of areas which have not yet been sufficiently evaluated. We also believe that it will present a great opportunity for the state of Alaska and for industry. We've worked very hard for a long time, as has been stated here today, with DNR and with all of industry, large, mid-sized, and small, and with the independent, to get a bill that we can all live with, even though it does not provide everything any one of us wanted. It is a bill that we think will work, and we all support it very strongly. For that reason, we sincerely hope that this body will pass the bill out of committee when appropriate, with essentially the same context as it currently exists. We realize that it has to be put in proper format, but as everyone else has said, it's a very fragile bill and it needs to remain with basically the same context.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. Are there any, in fact, I think I'm going to dispense with asking if any of the, committee or we have been joined by Representative Bill Williams of Ketchikan. If you have any questions at the termination of any of the testimony, just ask the questions at that time. And the same with the audience, if you have any questions, rather than to go through this format each time. Seeing none,
thank you,
Mr. Nelson. The next one is Brad Penn, representing Marathon.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Brad Penn, and I'm representing Marathon Oil Company. We're here in Anchorage. Marathon supports the October 25th legislation concerning exploration licensing. The bill provides a complement to the state's five-year leasing program and an opportunity to explore frontier areas. The bill represents a unanimous consensus that diverse companies on such areas as condo, relinquishment, conversion to lease, and work commitment with the license awarded on a sealed bid basis. In closing, I'd like to commend Ken Boyd and the Division of Oil and Gas for their efforts to work with industry to develop this legislation. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad. The next testifier is Mr. George Finley of Anchorage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is George Fidling. I'm the Manager of Government and Public Relations for ARCO Alaska Incorporated. I'm particularly pleased to be here to testify in complete support of this October 25th proposed committee substitute to House Bill 199. The bill provisions are very integrated and I might say a fairly elegant combination of mechanisms. And I wanted to expand on a couple of points on why I think this is such a good bill. First, it's a frontier bill, which includes the ANS and Cook Inlet exclusions. Second, it provides a very level playing field for the competition in awarding licenses. The best interest finding allows the commissioner the chance to fairly arbitrate in public the process of selecting bids. The bids are competitive, they're sealed, and they're based on total dollar amounts, so it's a very objective criteria. The bonding allows the same initial financial commitment on the part of each company. Each bidder. Licensees cannot achieve leases until all of the work is completed, and lease terms are attached to the license. So this provides a very fair, level playing field in the competition. It also provides strong incentives to do the work quickly. Losing the lease after 4 years of 25% has not been completed is a very good provision. The bonding provides incentives to do work quickly, and the relinquishment is tied nicely to work commitment or work completion in the fourth year and provides incentive to do work quickly. And finally, it fits into the existing system and supplements it very nicely in terms of existing leases. So again, I'd like to express complete support for the CS.
Representative Sanders?
George, considering your testimony and the support that you've given us over the years, can we almost assume participation by ARCO in this large population program? Billy Callen?
There are no promises. But what I can say is that this committee substitute has allowed us to begin thinking about frontier prospects that we would propose for exploration licensing. And we have not been able to do that until this CS was agreed to. Now, we don't want to talk about any particular areas, obviously, until the bill is passed and
thank you, Mr. Finley. The next person to be heard is Liz Shepherd from Anchorage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Elizabeth Shepherd, and I'm a landman with UNICAL, and my statement is very brief. It's just to say that I am here to voice UNICAL's support for AM's position and to support the October 25th draft bill. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm certainly pleased to hear that UNICAL is in favor of this. I went through some of those companies that were left being active in the state, and you get nervous when I'm glad to hear that from UNICAL. Thank you. The next person to be heard from, is Tom Williams with BP.
Williams. I'm Director of Government and Public Affairs for BP Exploration. On behalf of BP, I'd like to say that we also completely support the October 25th draft recommended to you as a committee substitute. We think that large block licensing is a useful addition to the state's conventional leasing program. It won't be a substitution for it. The Commissioner of Natural Resources will have discretion to decide which system to use in appropriate circumstances. But the experience elsewhere in the world is that these large track programs, in fact, can lead to discoveries as well as increased exploration activities. And discovery, of course, is what you really want to get. So we support the bill. We pledge that we will not seek to change it from this version as it moves forward. And in that regard, I know the chairman in his opening remarks mentioned that it has to be put into legalese. The Department of Natural Resources has already been assisted by counsel. I know there are drafting preferences between the Attorney General's office and the legislative, but again, I would remind, if I may, not sounding too, I don't want to sound arrogant or insolent, but you know, you gentlemen are the legislature, not your attorneys. And so if you have a bill that's in clear English and they understand, you know, it works. So just don't let drafting styles end up sliding us out and shattering the glass that Mr. Boyd was talking about. And finally, I would like to commend the other companies who have been working with us on this legislation, their patience with us, and their flexibility and willingness to compromise. I'd also like to commend Commissioner Noah for lighting a fire under us, telling us, you know, hey guys, you got to get your act together and reach agreement. Without that sort of initiative and leadership from the commissioner, we might still be talking about arcane points and not be here with the consensus legislation. And finally, greatest appreciation to Ken Boyd. He's the man in the asbestos suit who had to walk into the fire that Commissioner Noah lit. He has facilitated the discussions with great patience and ability, and this successful result is a tribute to his ability.
Thank you very much. I certainly appreciate your words of caution. I think they're well-founded, that we do, after all, perhaps need to stay abreast of what attorneys may have to do and say. Particular preference of styles may not necessarily be in order in all cases. With that in mind, if there are no other questions.
I'm sorry.
Yes, Representative Davis.
Mr. Williams, I think you're the first one to mention previous large tract leasing elsewhere, and that was going to be a question to anybody else that might have some input. How long has large tract leasing elsewhere been implemented, and has it run smoothly? Are there roadblocks? Are they looking at making some modifications to legislation that has been in effect, or what's the history of it elsewhere?
Okay. I'll confess that I'm not an expert in this area, but I'll try to give you the answer to the best of my knowledge. I don't think any other states in the United States have a large block program, although I could be wrong in that. I think most of them have gone with a conventional lease. That's partly because many other states have different land ownership patterns. Most of the land is in private hands, and there's not enough state lands to be talking about half-million acre tracts. Where it has been used more is by foreign countries. And BP's experience goes back to its very start back in the early 1900s in Iran. That was a concession. I forget how many thousand square miles it was for, but it was a huge tract of land. It was because our efforts were there proved to be successful, that we could get the financing to put in the refinery at Abadan, that in turn allowed the British Navy to say, okay, they'll use the oil from that refinery to fuel the ships instead of coal during World War I, and that's how BP got its start, in fact, and became successful. So at least that far back to the early days of this century, large tract concessions is what they're called usually overseas, have been commonly used, and I would say with varying degrees of success. You know, there have been times where nationalism and so on of a foreign country have led to expropriation, but we don't expect that to be a problem here.
Yes, would you agree that that really, while it goes back that far, it really got an impetus after World War II?
Of course it did, yeah.
So at least real aggressively 40 years and almost 100 years.
Behind the times.
Very much. And I think you make an excellent point that perhaps some of us fail to think about in that Alaska is unique among other states. Not only are we that big, but the ownership in the state is essentially all state ownership instead of even big oil producing places like Texas where it's essentially all private ownership. And that's a major difference. No other questions? Thank you, Mr. Williams. The next person to be heard is Walt Furness. I presume you're going to represent the alliance, or
yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Walt Furness, and I'm here today in my capacity as general manager of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance. The members of the alliance have had a chance to review House Bill 199, and more specifically, the October 25th, 1993 draft, and has voted to support that draft. We believe in the intent and purpose of the legislation at this time. We believe that the provisions are pertinent and necessary in order to establish a large block leasing program in the state of Alaska. On behalf of Board of Directors this morning, I want to commend you and your staff and members of this committee for the work that you've already done and work that we'll put forth in the coming months in order to see that this legislation is successful. We want to also acknowledge on the record our appreciation to the industry persons who have worked so diligently up to this point in order to bring this draft before us. Let me close by also parroting something that the last speaker had indicated. There is a concern that as the drafters get the bill and try to put it together, that there may be some substantial changes. I can assure you that as chairman of this committee, you have a great deal of control, power, and latitude to assure that this draft does not be substantially changed. Granted, there may be some form of whatever, but in terms of the substance of this bill, you, as chairman of this committee, control that process. I've had that experience, and I can assure you, all you need to do is draw upon the strength of your caucus, and you will prevail. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, on behalf of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, we stand ready to support you in any way. I will be spending some time in Juneau. We have some 320 members that are available. A number of these persons will be in Juneau to testify on behalf of legislation that will be before your committee. So all you need to do is let me know, and we'll call the troops out. We'll be there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Furness. And our next person to be heard from is Jerry Booth of Anchorage.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Booth, Vice President of Energy and Minerals for Cook Inlet Region, CERI, the Alaska Native Regional Corporation for the Cook Inlet area. CERI is owned by approximately 6,700 Athabascan, Eskimo, and Aleut shareholders. CERI owns and manages some 924,000 acres of surface estate and 1.6 million acres of subsurface estate in Alaska. It has been active in Alaska's oil and gas industry for over 15 years. CERI and its wholly owned subsidiary, Cook Inlet Region Production Company, hold various royalty and working interests in several producing prospective oil and gas fields on the Kenai Peninsula and Alaska's North Slope. A primary emphasis of CERI's strategy for economic growth is the continued development of its natural resource holdings. CERI believes that the large block leasing licensing is an excellent concept. It adds to the state of Alaska's leasing program to hopefully encourage exploration and development in areas of Alaska that are presently underexplored or not explored at all. The concept is a good start by the state of Alaska in providing incentives to attract back to Alaska the high-risk exploration dollars. Since the end of the last legislative session, last May, the Department of Natural Resources, led by Ken Boyd, have worked very closely with the industry group and has come up with what we call a fragile yet agreed to position where there's a lot of compromises that have been made, and we've come up with the exploration licensing as you've heard this morning. From this extensive effort, the Department of Natural Resources developed the October 25th, 1993 version. And SERI supports the concepts and positions outlined in the DNR industry draft of October 25th. And we suggest that when drafting the legislation from this agreed-upon compromise, that the concepts and the positions be held to as closely as possible. I heard just a few moments ago. In closing, I appreciate the opportunity to provide our brief comments to the House Oil and Gas Subcommittee and carefully crafted legislation developed from the DNR industry October 25 draft can help stimulate additional exploration for Alaska's oil and gas resources. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Booth, and it's certainly encouraging to hear that a Native corporation, as well as the oil and gas operators, as it were, is in favor of this, too. Thank you.
Well, bringing new people to Alaska kind of gets them to explore our lands. We're already implementing a program that's similar to the licensing program which you have before you. So a little bit similar.
Thank you. Next person to be heard is the last person to be heard, Mary Shields. Mary, yes.
Good morning. My name is Mary Shields. I'm General Manager for Northwest Technical Services. And I'm also the Alaska State Legislative Chair for the Alaska Federation of Business and Professional Women. On behalf of both organizations, my employees with Northwest Tech, who work within the oil industry, and the predominantly female base for the Alaska Federation of Business and Professional Women, many of whom are entrepreneurs, many of whom work within other industries besides the oil industry, I would like to congratulate our industry, our Department of Natural Resources, for putting together the October 25th compromise. It looks like we now have something we can move forward with. We are delighted to see this happen. As a board member of the Board of Directors for the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, this is a concept that we have been working on for many years. We are very pleased to see, again, movement take place, encourage you to follow the language that has been presented, and keep it simple so I can read it, and I don't have to have my attorney interpret it to me. Thank you very much.
Excuse me. Thank you very much, Ms. Shields. Are there any comments about what you've heard so far from any of our remote sites? Are there any people at any of the sites that would like to testify? Kotzebue, we've heard from you. Is there anyone there who would like to have any input?
This is Kotzebue. We're just listening. Thank you.
Have we gotten Fairbanks or Juneau?
No, just here listening. Thank you.
Fairbanks, are you with us?
Soldatna?
No, we're just listening. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who has not signed up that I don't have that would like to say anything at this time? I see Dave Lappy, who would certainly speak for the independents. Do you have anything to add, Mr. Lappy? I don't want to force you to say
anything. Thanks for your invitation. I'm Dave Lappy, President of Lapp Resources, Inc. We're an independent oil explorer based here in Anchorage. And I would just like to lend my support to the October 25th compromise. I guess the majority of the industry here in Anchorage met over the summer to hammer out that compromise, and a lot of work went into it by a lot of different companies. And I would support all the legislature to pass that early as you can. And hearing some of the comments that were made today, if this legislation does not promote a significant increase in industry activity as a result of the license program, I would heartily recommend that the industry get together with the DNR and come up with some new significant changes to the legislation to make it more appropriate and more competitive in an international marketplace. The exploration dollars are floating around internationally, and Alaska has to do what it can to keep itself competitive with opportunities in Colombia, Indonesia, Thailand, and other places. thanks for the opportunity.
Yes.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Mike Quick. Mr. Lappy.
Yes.
Is there opportunity for independence in this bill?
Yes, I believe there is. It, part of the opportunity is going to rest on how the regulations are implemented and what the state feels it needs in an exploration program in order to justify the cost of doing a public a best interest finding and put exploration acreage on the block for licensing. In other words, if the state believes a $10 million program is the minimum program that it would take for them to put some exploration acreage up, it may be difficult for small independents to play in this arena. However, if the state views the program such that we've got a lot of acreage out there that no one is exploring now, and the state is happy to see some exploration occur on that vacant acreage rather than hold out for the big one, I think that the program could be of interest to a significant number of independents that aren't operating in the state now. And obviously, we'd all like to see as many companies as we can exploring Alaska. So I think the answer to your question is that it's going to rest in the regulations and in the attitude of the Oil and Gas Division and the DNR.
Mr. Lappy, there is a minimum in the current version. There is a minimum of 20,000 acres that, as Mr. Boyd pointed out, to bypass nuisance or speculative, perhaps, securing of large areas of the state. That's something in, what, 30 square miles? That's still a pretty significant amount of acreage. Do you feel that that, or even perhaps, let's say, 19,999 acres would still, under a different bill altogether, not to be confused with this, would that still represent an area that maybe might not be attractive to a major company but might hold some promise for an independent?
I'm not sure I'm following what your point is, but the...
The concern I have, and you have, there was a some discussion about it, and I know bonding in the past over this difficult period, that I won't say difficult, this intense period during the interim, bonding as viewed from, say, a smaller organization versus a larger organization, it's been expressed that bonding is an extremely difficult issue for a smaller company.
That is entirely correct. I think bonding for small companies is probably non-existent. If a company wants to participate in this, if a small company wants to participate in the licensing program, they're going to have to put the cash in the state's bank account. And this gets back to my comments about the size of a program the state needs to feel comfortable awarding an exploration license. If they're looking for a $50 million or $100 million program over 10 years, that's obviously not something that a small company can bond because it has to come up with the cash in hand to hand the state government. However, if the state is happy with a smaller program, which a company could manage to bond with cash resources that it has, then the minimum program would be okay. The size of the acreage really doesn't come into that part of the equation. And getting back to your comments about the minimum. The minimum size of an exploration license, I see that 20,000 acres is not an unreasonable minimum to have. That's roughly the size of four current state leases. The maximum size of state lease is a little over 5,000 acres. So 20,000 acres would be roughly four state leases. And certainly that's well within the capability of independents to explore effectively, I believe.
Okay. Thank you very much. And without forcing the issue, I see Jack Roderick, who is certainly more familiar with the oil industry in Alaska than anyone I know. Jack, would you care to make any statements? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank
caught you cold, but...
Well, I am a little cold, but...
Thank you, Joe. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jack Broderick, a local citizen writing a book on the history of the oil industry. You're asking about the use of this concept. In the 50s, the federal government had something called the development contract. Phillips Petroleum was given 1 million acres down in the Icy Bay, Gulf of Alaska area. They drilled several wells. They weren't successful, but... And Chevron had about 350,000 acres in a development contract in the southern Kenai Peninsula. In the early 60s, Roscoe Bell, who is the director of Division of Lands, sent a person over to Canada to study their so-called checkerboarding system that they use in Alberta, came back and liked that idea of a concession. And as a matter of fact, he proposed it up on the North Slope. He was hoping to select about 3.5 million acres up there, first state selection, and then offer up to 500,000 acres for exploration. It didn't work out. We only selected 1.5 million acres in 64, which was not enough to do this concept. And of course, as you know, we then put the leases up on a bonus bid basis in 64 and 65. I mentioned the Alberta system, the checkerboard system. It's the same kind of concept. Put up a big tracts of land, let people explore, and the Crown takes back a certain portion. I think in their system, the Crown decides what 50% comes back, but I'm not exactly sure of that. But this whole concept of large spreads of acreage to encourage exploration, then the state or the government gets back part of it. It's a risk-sharing proposition, and I, from the little I know, particularly in these basins that have been looked at in the past, if this acts to get companies looking at it, it would be very, very useful, very, very good for the state. We need that more than just in two basins.
Thank you, Jack, and thank you for the insight. That's information that those of us on the committee were not privy to. I appreciate that. Any questions, Jack? He's a fountain of knowledge.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gustafson, I've been told that you might care to testify. Oh.
You can get them all up there yet, Joe.
Okay, I was misinformed. Anyone else that would care to make a statement? Any of our satellite LIOs? If not, then I would like to add my appreciation, certainly for all your work, Ken, and for the industry. Quite often, and again, I know the audience is aware of this, it's probably more for the committee's benefit, to arrive at a conclusion when particular company boards have a world market to look at, to focus in on what is best for a particular company, and then get 18 or 17 other players in this room to agree. I'm familiar with unitization work where everyone has an absolute common goal, and still it's a tooth-pulling situation, and sometimes we're threatened with not being fed until we have a result. I wholeheartedly join in my appreciation for the efforts that those of you in this room that were a part of that, to you, Ken, in particular, and any of those companies that weren't here. I only want to make sure that the committee is aware, not only in the more familiar areas of the world, but as a member of the Federal Energy Council, the meeting that we had in Dallas just a month and a half ago was essentially from Latin America, and they presented each of the countries. There were 11 countries represented, and each of them had mega-million-dollar programs that were not exploratory in nature. These were proven, rates of return, which were capital-intensive, needing dollars. And certainly the boards of directors of the companies represented here and those that have worked with you have got to look that way, too. So we are really in a very competitive place now to try and encourage exploration dollars, and I really, really do thank all of you. And that concludes the meeting. Thank you for coming.